Welcome everyone to today's Smart Macro Edition, and we're going to be speaking with our CIO at Financial Sense Wealth Management, Chris Poplava. So Chris, as we usually do on the Smart Macro segment, you provide your near-term outlook on the markets and the economy. Let's switch gears here a little bit and talk about some of the big picture things that you're looking at.
Well, I think what helps to kind of frame where I think things are going to go is to take a look over the last year and some of the big trends that have impacted things, where you've had fundamental strategists have been confused and made wrong calls, and you've also had technicians make some poor calls. And I think, Chris, honestly, fundamentals and technicals are really taking a back seat to something as simple as follow the money, where flows of money into and out of the economy, into and out of financial markets, are primarily the number one driver, I think, of developments in the last 12 months and likely for developments going forward. To give you an example of that, you know, when we looked at last year, the first 6 months, we saw a recession where we've had, you know, two quarters of negative GDP. The ISM manufacturing index was falling, which is why a lot of people were questioning if we were in a recession or heading into one. And we're certainly making calls for one going into 23. And we were among those calling for a recession based on what LEIs were telling us, the inverted yield curve, and all of the normal things that you see in terms of late cycle dynamics heading into recession. But, you know, one word to describe the economy last year is resilient. Same thing with the market. And so we've gone from everyone convinced we're going to have a recession to discussion of a soft landing. And even when the economy was picking up steam, you know, with housing turning around, so it seemed, discussion of a no landing, meaning we're not going to decelerate, but actually accelerate. And the calls for recession really, you know, dissipated. And what I think really caused this kind of flip from, you know, a real gloomy outlook to more of a benign outlook really has to stem from three key trends that had a huge influence, in my opinion, of turning the corner. And the question is will those continue or will those tailwinds become headwinds? And starting off, I would say the first one, which really kind of turned on a dime, is federal spending. So normally what you see in terms of the federal government is that when the economy is booming, unemployment rate is falling, tax receipts are coming in, you typically see a decline in government stabilizing payments and the government taking a role to help stabilize the economy. So expenditures go down, tax receipts go up, and so the budget deficit tends to fall as the economy expands. However, as we go into recession, when consumers retrench or businesses retrench, then the government steps back in, increases spending to help pull us out of a recession. And that's been the normal trend where you can basically chart the unemployment rate with the budget deficit, and you really can't tell the difference between them. But things really shifted and changed beginning with the Trump administration with Trump's tax cuts. He was doing that with a low unemployment rate, which basically blew out the budget deficit, rather than seeing the deficit continue to shrink prior to him becoming president. And that was the case all the way until we hit the COVID pandemic, where the unemployment rate shot up. And along with that came government spending, which as it normally does. However, when you look at mid-2020, Chris, to mid-21, the unemployment rate began to decline significantly, and yet our budget deficit continued to soar. And a lot of this was due to the multiple issuance of stimulus checks under the Biden administration. And, you know, just kind of giving you an idea of scale here, when we look at the Great Depression, the budget deficit ranged from 3.5 in 1932 to 6.1 in 1936. And when we look at the Great Financial Crisis, the peak of the Great Financial Crisis, we saw the budget deficit grow to 9.8. Another key period was World War II with huge government spending. The budget deficit grew to 6.3. So, you know, 6.1 record in the Great Depression, 6.3 World War II, 9.8 in response to the Great Financial Crisis. Nothing compares to what we saw in 2020 when the deficit exploded to 17.9. So it was just unreal and unlike anything we'd ever seen before. However, we started to finally see government spending recede by the middle of 21 as the unemployment rate was falling. So that's what we normally see. And that continued into the first half of 22, which the reduced spending by the government, which helped to fuel the economy's growth, that contributed to the recession that we saw, or, you know, decline in GDP in the first half of last year. However, by mid-22, we had a dramatic turnaround in government spending. And this was despite a falling unemployment rate. And when you look at all of the enactments by the Biden administration, the $700 billion Inflation Reduction Act, the $280 billion CHIPS and Science Act, and the $300 billion PACT Act, you add up all of those together, and we're talking over $1 trillion of increased government spending above its prior 12-month pace. So when we look at the economy and how the economy performed from the middle of last year to the middle of this year, it grew by $1.55 trillion. And of that increase, $940 billion was accounted for by increased government spending. So, you know, you look at the entire growth from, or, you know, from June last year to June this year, 60% of that came from an increase in government expenditures. So, you know, when you look at $1 trillion being injected into the economy over a short time frame by the government, it's pretty hard to get a recession. So I think the government had a huge impact in terms of, you know, pushing off the recession call. But, you know, when we look at what happened with the debt ceiling, basically back in June, President Biden signed the Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2023, and that essentially suspended the debt ceiling until January 25, but it also imposed spending caps on discretionary spending for fiscal 24 and fiscal 25. So what that means, Chris, outside of non-discretionary items, discretionary items like defense and other things, we're capped at what we spent in the prior fiscal year. So it is exceptionally unlikely that we're going to see any increase expenditures by the federal government over what they had spent over the last 12 months. So I don't think we can count on that being a huge source of stimulus over the next 12 months, as it was in the prior 12.
It's just 60% of U.S. GDP and economic growth was really coming from government spending over the past 12 months. What are some other things you're looking at that may change the outlook from last year to this year?
Well, part of what we saw last year that compounded the decline in equity prices is what was going on in the U.S. equity futures market. So going into 2022, you look at U.S. equity futures positioning, and this comes from data from Goldman Sachs looking back a decade. What we saw was at the end of 21, the large institutions, commodity trading firms, you know, risk parity funds like Ray Dalio's Bridgewater All-Weather Fund, they were essentially looking at kind of the extreme in terms of long position. So when we look at where they were in 2018, you know, they had a roughly around 700 billion long position. That was kind of near the peak of what we saw in 2018 before that correction. And then going into 2020, just before COVID, they were also long roughly around 700 billion. So that was a pretty huge long position. And by the end of COVID, or that sell-off in 2020, they were about 200 billion short position. So, you know, you're talking about $900 billion, you know, swing. That's pretty huge in terms of what happened in COVID. But coming out of COVID, they began to re-leverage, cover the short position. And by the end of 22, they were back to being roughly around 700 billion long in U.S. equity futures positioning. So that was back to the extremes that we'd seen. And the extremes that we saw were very fleeting. You know, they didn't stay in those elevated territory. And then we had the bear market kick in 22. So they went from a $700 billion long position. And by the time we reached October, they were around a $500 billion short position. So part of the pain that we saw last year came from a $1.2 trillion swing based on large institutions in terms of U.S. equity futures positioning. So, you know, when I look at the prior lows that we had seen, you know, 2015, 16, or even at the COVID bottom panic in 2020, the biggest short position we saw was roughly around 200 billion. So we were more than double that last year in October of about 500 billion. And the data that I saw going through July of this year shows that not only did U.S. large institutions cover a $500 trillion short position, they went long the market by $400 billion. And this goes into July. So I haven't seen recent data. But we're talking, Chris, $900 billion in terms of a positioning swing back into the market. And that was, you know, one of the biggest ones that we had seen. And it more or less matched what we saw in terms of their short covering coming out of the COVID crash. You know, that was roughly a $900 billion swing. So, you know, let's just say give or take $1 trillion, you know, at $400 billion, we're getting back up to that rarefied territory. Not quite at 700 billion. Maybe we got there in August or September. I'm not sure. But at least as of July, that was a huge source for why the market, I think, did so well in terms of money flowing back into largely U.S. equities. And when you think about it, when you buy U.S. equity indexes, you're basically buying the S&P, which therefore means you're buying Apple, because 8% of every dollar you, or $100 you put into the S&P is going to Apple, $8 going to Microsoft, and so forth. So I think that's kind of really what helped to explain the discrepancy between the S&P versus other indices like the Dow, or even just looking at the sector level, tech versus other sectors. And so, you know, at $400 to $500 billion long position, Chris, I mean, how can you add another $1 trillion to that? That would just be unfounded and never, you know, unlike anything we've ever seen. So I can't see an additional $1 trillion coming in leveraged futures positioning by institutional players. So I think that tailwind most likely could turn into a headwind, particularly if volatility picks up like we've seen over the last month and a half. The last kind of significant tailwind, Chris, that I would say that we've seen is coming from the Fed's repo facility. So we know the Fed can adjust monetary policy by raising and lowering interest rates, adjusting their balance sheet, but another way is by adjusting the amount of liquidity in the system through the repo facility. So they can grow the reverse repo facility by making the rates attractive, drawing money away from money centers, which basically takes it out of the U.S. financial system, or they can kind of make it unfavorable relative to treasury rates and get money centers to push that money back into the financial system. And so what we saw, Chris, was, you know, when you look at 2021, the Fed was doing QE, but we were starting to see cracks in the market. You know, first we saw in early 21, small cap stocks petered out, non-profitable tech companies like, you know, Cathie Wood's famous ARK fund peaked, Bitcoin peaked. So we're seeing signs of markets peaking, which is a sign of liquidity peaking, and yet the Fed was doing QE. And the part of the reason for that, Chris, was while the Fed was doing, let's say, give or take $100 billion a month of injection, so, you know, $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion on an annual basis of new money, money was going out the back door through the repo facility. That exploded in 21, in March of 21, from zero to, by the end of 21, $1.8 trillion. So it was nearly twice the pace of what the Fed was doing, which was starting to show why we were getting cracks in the system. Well, just the opposite has happened in the last year. So when we look at going into late 22, so let's say, you know, roughly October, November, and at the end of the year, the repo facility stood about $2.6 trillion. That, Chris, has declined down to about a little over $1.4 trillion. So we are talking over $1 trillion of liquidity injection by a decline in the Fed's repo facility just in the last 9 to 10 months. So think about that. $1 trillion of increased fiscal spending, $1 trillion of increased injections of money flowing to the financial markets from U.S. equity futures positioning, $1 trillion coming into financial markets by the repo facility falling. I mean, we're talking, Chris, $3 trillion in the last 12 months. I mean, how in the world can you have a bear market and or a recession when the government injects $1 trillion, you got $2 trillion coming into financial markets? And when you step back and think about that, Chris, that's a lot of money. And what did we get for it? The market didn't hit a new all-time high. And particularly when you look at small caps, mid caps, or even, you know, other sectors, they didn't hit a new high. Regional banks hit a 52-week low this year. The retail sector is languishing. And today we just got news that consumer spending in the GDP report was revised heavily down. So my question is, what happens when we don't have $3 trillion to throw at the economy and financial markets? How do they perform? And to me, Chris, that's the risk going into 24, is that we can't count on the government. We're not likely to count on U.S. leverage position, futures positioning trading. The only wild card, in my opinion, Chris, is the repo facility. You got $1.4 trillion still there, and it's really tough to say whether that goes up or down. I mean, it's kind of, you know, difficult to get into the head of money centers in terms of what they'll do. But I could say pretty confidently, at least two of those three massive levers that help stabilize things, I think, are going to be gone as we go into 24.
Well, as we close out today's show, please remember to spread the word about Financial Sense NewsHour with your friends and family. As always, today's podcast is brought to you by Financial Sense Wealth Management, which has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. If you have any questions about our asset management or our financial planning services, feel free to click where it says contact us on financialsense.com, or you can also call us directly at 888-486-3939.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.